Another episode of the Research Conversations podcast. And today we have with us Torsten Schutte, who just completed his fantastic film on Frank Zappa called Eat That Question. Frank Zappa, in his own words, it's June 2016. Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you. It's my first time here. I'm
Oh,
thrilled.
and you came all the way from Germany, correct?
I came all the way from Germany. Yes, actually right now I'm coming from Los Angeles, where we had a couple of press premiere screenings and press appointments, and now it's San Francisco, and tomorrow it's New York.
Ooh. First of all, Frank Zappa's first album is one of the, maybe the very first album I ever purchased with my own money when I was a little kid. So that's maybe of interest. But the second point that I thought when I saw your film is that this is kind of an amazing film in that probably the only footage that your team shot was the beginning and ending titles, and everything else is live, what I call primary source. As an amateur anthropologist, that's very important. Primary source, words from the man, the artist himself, the genius himself, whatever you want to call him. And I thought, this is like hip hop in a weird way. You can make a film without owning a camera. You see what I mean? Or playing an instrument. You know, it's a different kind of artistic possibility. Because I know you did this incredible amount of work going all over the world, finding these really rare clips, and then thinking a long time and putting in the perfect order so it builds and it actually ends, and you would just keep going wow the whole time, at least I do.
Well, since you can't see us here, I'm smiling all over my face hearing this question, and I really do appreciate it because, yes, it was a conscious decision to do this film solely on archive. And yes, we didn't shoot a second. The sequence that you're talking about is computer-generated images, so it was done by our graphic designer.
The first film made without a camera, more or less.
No, there's been lots of them.
Well, for you maybe, but anyway, that was my thunderstruck revelation.
So, as the director, though, you were obviously collecting the footage, and then were you making most of the decisions? Had you left a lot out that just there wasn't room for, or it didn't add to the story, or how'd that work?
Well, thank you for mentioning it. Yes, we're not the first film that was solely done on archive. We're pretty much aware of that, but there's less and less of these films to be seen because usually in these days archives cost a hell of a lot of money, you know, and there's good reasons why we have many of those formulaic music documentaries that always follow certain stereotypic patterns of storytelling. Actually, the offspring of this whole idea was that we unearthed material in archives of which we knew that they were not available, accessible, known about, and also, you know, behind this discovery was the realization that a whole different Zappa emerges from the person that we used or seem to know, you know, and that we could tell his story beyond the stereotypical and cliches that he was labeled at most of the time. And about the working process, yes, what you do is you have to go into the vaults, you have to do the research. We actually hired a specialist to do that, Elizabeth Kling from Toronto, who is an archive footage researcher and clearing agent. Together with a fan base, so to say, we knew where to look and what we were looking for because the fan base curates a database that gives you an idea, you know, from when till when Zappa was where, what he said on radio, etc., here and there. So one of the tasks was to verify if those things do still exist, if they exist at all, and also to complete this list because Fanbase work is a labor of love, and it's far from completion, and it may never will be, you know, completed. So that worked well hand in hand. And yes, along the way, since we as TV directors, producers are a little bit more privileged than fans, we can go to the archives, you know, so we found a lot more of things that were there. But eventually the film also made use of certain footage that was once upon a time broadcasted but hasn't been seen for a very long time. So that is material that is probably known to the hardcore fans, but to the general public out there, not that much. And we also have to face the fact, you know, that Frank Zappa is very present in a specific kind of generation. But to a younger audience, you know, you sometimes get the question from people saying, who's that man with a beard?
Yeah. And it did look also that as you found these various pieces of footage in the stations and where different places they taped him, you used things that wouldn't probably have been used originally. It was nice the way you lingered on his face and you could see his reactions to these questions and how he was trying to get with the program, whatever the interviewer was saying. It was kind of hilarious in a way that he sat there, that early one, and said, okay, what do I say? You have nothing better to do than, I mean, it was just, he was so cooperative that it was just amusing. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, many of the things were produced, you know, for very quick news pieces, but then of course the original footage, the raw footage, is always much longer. And what was probably to the people back then cutouts, you know, and ended up on the editing floor, for us was very dear, you know, because it was revealing so much of his character behind the scene, you know, and we wanted to bring that to the forefront because the film is also very much about Frank Zappa's very complex relation towards the media.
You had to narrow it somehow. What was it that wasn't used?
Well, the film is 90 minutes long, and we were working with 150 hours of footage, so it's almost 148 hours that fell on the side, consisting of lengthy interviews, concert performances, you name it, you know, there's plenty of things that you can't use, but also certain things perpetuated, or not perpetuated, they repeated itself in the footage. One can say, for example, that it is very difficult to find Zappa footage from the early 60s, you know. First of all, because by that time he was not that present in the media. Second, you know, TV wasn't that omnipresent like it today was. And third, you know, most of those things that have been recorded then, actually then many times things were not even recorded. They were broadcasted, but they were not saved on tape. So that is just, one has to know it through TV history, you know, that was one of the procedures. So there's good reasons why the early Zappa is not that much present on camera, while the PMRC debate in the 1980s was many hours long. You know, you could have done a sole film on the PMRC debate because there's so much footage about it. You know?
About what's that?
The Parents Music Resource Center debate on the censorship.
Tipper Gore.
PMRC, Tipper Gore. So there's already an imbalance in the footage, and that gives you, of course, also a kind of lead of what to bring to the forefront, because you want to see more of that and maybe less of that. So you have to handle that. And then there's also recurring themes and core subjects that were very dear to him that he wanted to bring across. I mean, censorship is an ongoing narrative in his life story. So we had to connect the dots, you know, from the early beginnings to the very end. And they strongly connect to each other. Another thing that was also interesting, and it's good that you're asking for it, was the fact that his political statements, especially in the early albums, in the lyrics, they are not recorded so often. Why is that? First, because there are not that many TV recordings from the early 60s in the US. And when he was touring Europe, where he was well documented in the late 60s, he He did not put many of those songs in his repertoire because he was more going for the instrumental music, and so therefore you don't have many of those songs being recorded, though they were very strong in his repertoire. Therefore, we were so happy that we had Trouble Every Day and Plastic People, those very small snippets, you know, from the German broadcaster there, you know.
Another technical question. I know in this country, things were often filmed in 16 millimeter and then broadcast, but did you find any of that?
Well, 16 millimeter, yes. I mean, the footage that you see in the film, very much at the beginning, there is 60 millimeter. The one that I just spoke about, Plastic People, this is 60 millimeter footage. So the footage from the Dutch TV, where he's at home composing, talking about 200 motels, it's all 60 millimeter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was wondering why you didn't include a little clip of the actual 200 motels final film.
That's a legal and rights and strategic question, as you can imagine, because what we did is because the film from what I now know on top of my head, it belongs to United Artists, or I don't know to whom it was handed over, but it's a film that it's one of the few things that he does not control. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, the clearance of that would have been pretty difficult. So luckily we had images from the making of the 200 motels, so that at least we could give a taste of that.
Okay, I suspected as much.
I think that you have to start with a pretty concrete, fleshed out, almost archetype that appeals to a lot of people's idealism, like me. And I didn't know this about this at all. And he's way more complex than I thought. And well, I mean, the very obvious first question I was going to ask you was why did you pick Zappa? Because he is not, that from my standpoint, that well known in America, and that's going out on a risk.
Well, that brings us back to your first statement and your first question, because your first record, Freak Out, was also my first record, you know. And the moment I heard Who Are the Brain Police, I was... How can you say it? I was thrilled, mesmerized, you know. I never recovered from it again. You know, I found it so profound and complex. I wanted to learn more about that, you know.
Yeah, for me that tied right in with one of my mentors that I got to do projects with, William Burroughs, because he had that paranoia, you know, of against the control process. Why are so many people not creative? Why aren't they all creative? Why isn't there a lot more rebellion of the good kind, creative rebellion in the world? You know, like, a lot of people get beaten down so much that only a few, like Zappa, seem to just, they have the film vision, and that's what they make happen.
Is it totally chronological?
Almost. We were thinking a long time about the narrative, and I thought in the beginning I had this idea of starting with a PMRC debate, you know, where he's very strong with his statements. But then I realized, wait a minute, you know, if you would do that, first of all, you know, he looks pretty different, shorter haircut and so on. Second, you know, none of the whole backstory is present, so you would overburden an audience that knows very little of him. You know, you would be puzzled if that would work. So we dropped that idea pretty quickly. So what was the question now again?
Oh, I just wondered if the editing was mostly ruled by the chronology.
Yeah. The chronology. Then we sorted? We sorted the material,
yeah.
You know, along recurring themes. That was the main work. Then we realized that actually, no, I have to correct myself, because we sorted it by themes, but the first edit was not in a chronological form. You know, we decided, for example, that his earlier years would have been told only in the middle of the film. But then we realized that it does good to the film to position the bicycle concert at a very prominent position very early in the first third of the film, you know. So that's storytelling and narrative processes you just try out in the editing to experiment where, at which position the material unfolds its power to the fullest. And so yes, the film is mainly chronological. There's a few, 1 year comes a little later than the other, but that is really for the fans, or you would not sense. You can maybe tell it by the hair length or the hairdo of Zappa, where we are, but it doesn't matter so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My favorite part of the film was the Kent Nagano LSO, London Symphony Orchestra footage. I said, wow, he spent his own money so he could hear what his music sounded like. That's beyond capitalism.
That's actually a good example to come to an end, you know, of making choices, because we also had the Ensemble Intercontemporain footage with Pierre Boulez that he did only a year afterwards, you know. Ooh. So now you're sitting there, are you taking both? Probably not, you know, because then it would be too repetitive, you know. Are you taking Nagano because he came first, or are you taking Boulez because he's by that time he was more known than Nagano? So these are the situations that you're sitting with in the editing room every once in a while.
Well, to me it worked because, well, he's an Asian, naturally I'm gonna like that. But
yes,
we had to
think of our world audience, you
oh,
know,
I
to
know,
balance it out.
I know, I know. But you don't want it to be all white men either, at least from my viewpoint. And whether it was chance or not that you picked Nagano over Boulez. But I didn't know it was pronounced Boulez. I always thought it was Boo. I don't know what I thought it was. But he's from San Francisco, you know, which I can relate to. And then, so pairing Kent Nagano with the London Symphony Orchestra, and what was the name of that famous place? The
Barbican.
Barbican, thanks. I mean, that brings this whole international synergy together, which is what you've managed to do, because you have a producer from France and another producer from Germany, and you made what I would consider a very challenging, in terms of strict commerciality, project actually happen, and it's all primary source. That's what's important to me. It's not a bunch of people I don't care about talking, it's him talking.
Yeah, but it's extremely accessible to anybody,
exactly.
Which is great. Did the estate and the family, Gail, who's mentioned a lot, was she involved after she agreed? I know it seemed like it was hard to get her to agree, but once she did she just let go, or did she come and help you or offer suggestions? Was she allowed to?
Well, in a nutshell, it went like this, you know. It took me 2 years to approach Gail, you know, to get a hold of her, to talk to her about the project. All in all, it took us 8 years to make the film, you know. So I approached her first in 2008. In 2010, the first encounter happened. I saw her, showed her the materials. We sat for a couple of hours discussing it. She was very much moved by the things that we already had found. Then, and she liked the idea, you know, that there's somebody going out into the world and looks up in archives what is still there. So that was also of great interest to her. And so we had a mutual understanding and agreement of, yes, I can do the film and I bring something back that she's interested in also. Then the following years, we were basically working on contractual issues, you know, because there were at the beginning, and I fully understand and respect that, fears, how can they make sure that we leave the integrity of the musical work unharmed, so that we don't mutilate or distort his character? And it's a very difficult thing, you know, because you as a director want final cut, but the other person doesn't know you and doesn't know your true intentions. So that was going back and forth, and eventually I think we just decided to trust each other, and Gail gave me final cut. So we were in touch via phone every once in a while. I went to Los Angeles, or we met up in Europe and talked about the project and about the things that I found, but she was not part and parcel of the editing process in itself. We only came back to her once we had a first rough cut that was almost in its shape like the way it is now. I think it was 3 or 4 minutes longer. She saw it 2 months before she passed away.
Gail passed away?
You didn't know?
No, I didn't know that.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, she passed away last October.
So. Wow.
Yeah, she was in her 70s.
Wow. No, that's not obvious, you know, in the film. Even there was a credit at the end for Gail, but it didn't. I didn't make the connection.
Mm.
Wow. Well, that's great that she was there to that long of it.
No, we knew about her illness some time before that, so we were really hoping that she stays strong, and she did for a very long time. And also when I saw her the last time, she was in good shape, but you never know, those things happen. And yeah, so I'm very happy, you know, that we had the opportunity to finish this together, that she saw it, that she loved it very much, she approved it, and
I'm sure it simplified it a little bit too, just because once, if she's not there and then you're dealing with her four children, you know, everything gets more scattered and complicated, I guess. Yeah, but she could be the decisive person.
It's true. I didn't see Dweezil's name mentioned, but maybe I fell asleep for a second in the film watching. I mean, I said, where's Dweezil? But I don't know.
In the credits?
In the credits.
I mean, it's not in the paperwork.
Yeah.
But...
see, there's Amit, Moon, and Diva.
No, this is what you mean. No, all of the kids, I mean, I thank them for their support, but actually it is because I always spoke to Gail throughout the process, you know. Yeah. It was her who was representing the family trust by the time we started in 2008, and it was her I last spoke to when she approved the rough cut, and only after that, you know, I got to know the kids a bit more. Diva was around most of the time when we always met, you know, because she was still with Gail, I think around the house most of the time. Moon and Dweezil I first saw in person when we met in London 2010, but I never really got to know them any closer. Amit I hadn't seen at all for most of the time. So now, you know, after Gail's passing, it's a different situation, and I got to know all of the kids much better. You know, they were most of them were with us in Sundance. Finally, I also had the opportunity to meet and talk to Dweezil. He came to the premiere now in Los Angeles, and it was really cool. He invited me to one of his rehearsals because he's going on tour soon again. Yeah, it took some time, you know, to get to know each and everyone, but I'm happy now that I'm more familiar with all of them.
What is the age spread, approximately?
I think some of them are my age. I think Moon and Dweezil are born in the late 60s, and I think Amit and Diva are born mid and late 70s, but you have to look it up yourself.
Curious, approximate, And was there much that you had to eliminate just due to character? You didn't like that it didn't fit the character you were portraying in the film? Or was Frank Zappa super consistent in most of the footage? I mean, in what you present, he's very consistent.
I think we are fully aware of the fact that you cannot tell the story of somebody's life in 90 minutes, and nor would you want to. You know, there are certain key themes and key motives that you would want to bring to the forefront, and other less interesting things. So we made a conscious decision that we do not focus so much on the private Zappa. First of all, because he himself protected his privacy very much. Second, because the footage is not really there to do so, and it would also lead into a lot of speculation. So we would rather go for those things, you know, that had a consistency in itself, you know, where you could see how outspoken he was on certain things, because the things that he constantly repeated obviously were things that were very dear to him, you know, and this is what we wanted to emphasize. There are numerous subjects, you know, that you could dwell much deeper onto. You know, there's this his activity in the financial news network that he was doing in the late 1980s. You could go much deeper into the whole Sinclavier experimentation issue. You could talk massively about the different incarnations of the groups. You know, we also leave that aside very much. You know, we had an earlier version where we thought it would be so much more important to understand, you know, the early mothers to the middle and the late mothers and so on, but it turned out for us that that is not key. You know, other films already have done that. Future films can still do that, you know, but as a director, you have to make decisions, and these are the decisions that we made.
Okay, sure. Do you think you would do another project?
Not at the moment. You know, it's something you have to feel it. You have to see that in front of your inner eye. And I don't intend to become the chronicler of Frank Zappa for the future. You know, I'm very much interested in him. I'm always happy to see more and discover other aspects and so on. I think each album of his could deserve its own celebration, dedication. There's so much more one could do, you know. But I'm also busy with great many other things and interests, so this is where I'm going to move on from now. And who knows, one day maybe you have this epiphany and say, let's do something about, I don't know.
Okay, sure. And what are your future plans?
Let me tell you one thing. There are podcasts, for example, on the net, you know, where people are discussing the evolution and development of the specific songs of his, you know. And of course, this is really hardcore fan talk, you know, but I love listening to those kind of things, you know, where, like, really in detective mode, those fans go into bootleg recordings and say, look, there's this first improvisation called that da 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 that finally ended up as the third movement of Sinister Footwear. So that is a proof that he was already working by that time on this and this and that. So it's really, you know, in the Zappa universe, it's great fun, you know, to see with the dedication with which the friends are investigating each and everything. You know, they are insatiable. Yeah, but for a broader audience, you know, that can also be fatigue to a certain extent, but I like it. So other projects, yes, I am currently, it's a project I'm working on for over 6 years now. It's about the forgotten and almost made impossible music of Southern Africa. Under apartheid, the project is called Stolen Moments, Namibian Music History Untold, and that is going to turn into an international exhibition. It's not so much...
An art show, you mean? Visual art show?
Yes, yes. It's not a film, but it's let's call it multimedia, for a lack of a better word. It contains unheard recordings, photography, oral history, film, artwork, a variety show of things. So this is what we're currently busy with.
Is that, you say Southern Africa, is that the same as what I think of as South Africa?
Well, I always say Southern Africa because we're in this case not talking about South Africa, we're talking about Namibia. Namibia was Southwest Africa before it got independent, and it was controlled, occupied by South Africa until its independence in 1990. So
didn't know.
This is what we're focusing on. So for those who are not so familiar with the African continent, just for a better orientation, we say Southern Africa, and then when you ask back, then we talk Namibia, because many people, you know, ask you, no, what, you know, we're talking about Namibia.
That's true. I barely heard the word Namibia. First time I ever said it. How did that happen? That you even, I mean, you're from Germany, and then you're in doing a project trying to uncover, document, and preserve this music that you must probably personally like, you know, in some obscure, to me, place. And how did that happen?
Well, maybe I owe it to Frank Zappa, who taught me somehow to be able to be in several places at the same time, you know? It definitely helps as a documentary filmmaker, you know, if you're able to cook on different plates at the same time, because you never can expect everything to be ready at the same time. Certain things take a lot of research, certain things take a lot of financing to get done, you know, so this is why things take time. And I'm, you know, apart from the music documentary filmmaking that I'm doing, I'm for over 10 years now been doing documentary filming in Namibia. You know, I dedicated myself to several subjects.
You mean with a real camera?
With a real camera, yes. I can. The first one, even as a cinematographer, so there's one project called Namibia Generation X. It's about the first post-apartheid generation and black and white kids going to school together after the country got independent. The second film is dedicated to the land reform, you know, and of ownership of farmland, you know, and how neighborhood works between white established farmers and black upcoming farmers. And the latest film that we've been doing is a film about farm workers' rights. So it's more kind of an activist film, you know, to empower farm workers whose situation on the ground is pretty miserable. And along this 10 years of work, when I was doing press and promo for one of the films in Namibia, I ran into music in their archive, because I'm a archive buff, you know. I always, if you let me in, I always start to sniff out what is there, and I got very curious, and I had this musical encounter there with an artist that was recorded but never published. His name is Ben Molazzi. He's a teacher and bus driver today, but in the 70s he was an upcoming artist that never had a career, and I thought we have to do something about it, you know, because there are so many artists that are totally unheard so far. And soon we're going to provide them with a platform to show and play their music and hopefully make it accessible again. So that's what we're working on.
And the platform meaning
the exhibition.
Your film? Oh, the exhibition, which includes all of the different arts, and your film will play.
No, there's no film.
No, okay.
There's film footage. Maybe we're going to turn it into a film one day, but since film is the most expensive, you know, of many of those outlets, we have to be very patient to get that done.
Okay. But you'll at least document it all somehow.
Yes, probably. Yes. We went over a couple of years into the field and produced 120 hours of oral history recording, so there's a whole cornucopia of things that the world will soon get their eyes and ears on.
That included music.
Yes.
Good.
And you seem to be on the helping. I mean, is it hard to get people to open up and let you work with them? I mean, how do you get there and show up as a German filmmaker and you just get to know one person at a time, or
no? I think it's just like with us, you know. We see each other for the first time, we look each other in the eyes, and then we have to decide if we want to connect or not. And maybe we share some common ground, and you are curious, I am curious. So as long as you're open-minded, it might lead to something fruitful.
On the long-range term, that's what life's all about. You never know what projects are just by chance, you know, they appear to you.
No, it's like I said before, you hear something inside of you, you want to do it, you create a certain energy and the nature that makes you go getting for it, and the rest is patience, luck, finances, willpower, goodwill of others. You know, we don't control all of the factors, but I think we can create a certain spirit or karma to make things work. And the rest, is destiny.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for meeting with us.
Thank you for coming here and talking to me.
You've been listening to Research Conversations. We've been talking to filmmaker Torsten Schutt. This podcast series is brought to you by Research Publications, publishers of Modern Primitives, Pranks, Incredibly Strange, and many other popular subjects. See them all at www.researchpubs.com.